Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You must remember a kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh.
Welcome to You Must Remember This, the podcast dedicated to exploring the secret and or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century. I'm your host, Karina Longworth, and this is another installment of our ongoing series, Polly Platt, The Invisible Woman. By 1990, Polly had been working with James L. Brooks for almost a decade, but only on a film-to-film basis, and not as a full-time contracted employee. In 1990, when Brooks signed a new deal to move his Gracie Films production company from Fox to Sony, Polly was finally given a full-time job, with a contract. It included an extra $100,000 on top of her salary for each picture she produced, as well as a one-time-only bonus as acknowledgement of her previous work to Gracie in an unofficial capacity, particularly on the film she had hoped to direct, The War of the Roses. Sony had taken over the old MGM lot via the tech giant September 1989 acquisition of Columbia Pictures. The studio was about to enter into an unprecedented period of excess and greed, marked by major money losers like Mr. Saturday Night and Hudson Hawk, presided over by John Peters and Peter Goober, the executive team that had caused so much frustration on Witches of Eastwick. But Goober had personally wooed Brooks and offered him much more money than any other studio because he felt that once he and Peters lured one piece of blue-chip talent, every other major creator in Hollywood would follow. Gracie Films moved into the old MGM costume building, and this is how Polly described the early, productive years there.
I hired my stepdaughter, Kelly Wade, to be my assistant. I searched the town for screenplays. The most I knew about Jim's deal at Sony was that we could make almost any picture we wanted if it was fewer than $20 million. So I looked and looked. I found Callie Curry, having read her script for Thelma and Louise. In the meantime, she had been nominated for an Academy Award for her screenplay, but we managed to sign her up with a very rich deal to do another picture, which she would direct. Cameron was writing another picture with Jim to be called Jerry Maguire. We got J.J. Abrams to write a script about 4 years at college called All 4 Years. Jim was writing a musical to be called I'll Do Anything.
To footnote this a bit, though Callie Curry would not direct a film for Gracie, Jerry Maguire, released in 1996, would become the highest-grossing live-action Gracie Films release ever, and the second highest of any release, behind The Simpsons Movie. J.J. Abrams' college script became the TV show Felicity, and I'll Do Anything became a legendary disaster.
Writer-director James L. Brooks presents a movie set in Hollywood.
Let's cut out the acting stuff and focus on what's important. Would you go to bed with him?
It's a tough town to get a break.
I must get work. I will take anything. I must get work. I must not be embarrassed by these pep talks to myself.
I'll Do Anything, from the creator of Broadcast News and Terms of Endearment.
One of the biggest money losers and most negatively gossiped about movies of the 1990s, I'll Do Anything emerged from 3 years of troubled development and tortured post-production as a musical without any music. Though as many as a dozen musical numbers had been planned, set to songs written by Sinead O'Connor, Carole King, and Prince, the film would be released without any musical numbers. And the musical version has never seen the light of day. The painful process of making and releasing this film would put untenable wear and tear on Polly's relationships with her co-workers, including James L. Brooks. She would produce just one more film for Gracie Films, and that film would launch the career of one of the only directors who still has carte blanche to make original films today. Join us, won't you, for part 9 of Polly Platt, The Invisible Woman. Polly's new position at Gracie put her officially in the center of Hollywood creative power in the early 1990s, as Rachel Abramowitz explains.
She was at Gracie Films, and that was Jim Brooks' company, and Jim Brooks was, you know, the man. He was a superstar, deservedly so. So she was, like, at, like, the hottest, one of the hottest companies. Simpsons was beginning, and he had this huge TV career, and it was broadcast news, and it was sort of the apex of that time.
The job was a reflection of the bond and mutual appreciation between Brooks and Polly.
They were really, really close. And I think Polly just absolutely believed in Jim's talent with, like, fervor. And I think Jim believed in Polly. I mean, Jim, you know, gave her a home and made her a valuable part of that team and told everyone that he thought she was incredibly smart and she valued her opinion. He just sort of lifted her up into the world of Hollywood. Jim's confidence in her gave her currency. I mean, everyone knew what she had done, but it's sort of like, oh, what did you do for me lately? What did you do for me lately? And that just made her current in that world.
Lisa Maria Rodano began working with Gracie Films in the early 1990s.
You know, she, Richard Sakai and Jim were this sort of funny little triumvirate, you know. Richard was this grumpy genius at money, you know, I mean, and at just making everything work. You know, Polly and Jim would say, we want to do this. And Richard would be like, oh, I don't know, we're going to do that. And then he'd make it work.
Polly had never had this kind of job before. She was used to being an artist, not a bureaucrat, not a cog in the machine. And she wrote frankly about her frustrations with being part of this pinnacle of the Hollywood establishment.
The problem for me at Gracie started when we moved into larger quarters and everyone wanted an office with a bathroom in it and lots of square footage and all kinds of stupid crap like that. The other problem was that we had all these talented writers arriving all at the same time, basically, and they all wanted Jim's time. They came to me with their frustrations, and I disliked being the go-between, the gatekeeper. Jim was busy writing his musical, and I honored that and did my best to be of help to the writers. I worked closely with J.J. Abrams, who was very creative and innovative. But this was Jim's deal. The writers came to work with him, and to a certain extent, he wasn't available. I promised myself that I would not stay at Gracie for long if this was to be my role, other than finding scripts.
One wonders if Polly's feelings would have been different if she had been running interference for Brooks while he was writing another Terms of Endearment or Broadcast News. In other words, another totally original masterpiece that only James L. Brooks could pull off. Instead, for the entire time Polly was under contract to Gracie, the company was consumed with Brooks's would-be musical, I'll Do Anything, which even Brooks couldn't pull off. Brooks conceived I'll Do Anything, which was at one point titled It's Only a Movie, as a film about the state of Hollywood in that exact moment. It was always meant to include characters working jobs that hadn't existed in previous depictions of the film industry, from young, ambitious D-girls working on script development to the research agents who had begun contracting with the studios to collect statistics on test screenings that could be used to refine a film's editing and marketing. But Brooks wanted to tell this new Hollywood story by using a genre as old as talkies, the musical. As he told the LA Times, the music allows me to show an aspect of a character in a way I could never do with just dialogue. But one problem was that Brooks wasn't a songwriter, and he declined to write the script in collaboration or consultation with lyricists and composers. Instead, writing in placeholders for songs that hadn't been written yet. As one studio memo explained, quote, "The script is very long at 140 pages. Parts of some songs are included, but the script indicates 12 to 13 songs. Without knowing more about what they will be, it's difficult to judge their exact impact." That memo was dated March 20th, 1992. By then, as Brooks's papers reveal, Polly had already been trying to get Brooks to consider working with songwriters for at least 10 months. In June 1991, she had sent him memos about meeting with Joe Jackson. She sent him a copy of the CAA Performing Artists roster with a number of singers and songwriters circled, including Michael Bolton, Mariah Carey, and Barry Manilow. By October of that year, songwriters were still being considered, ranging from Don Henley to Janet Jackson to David Byrne. One memo stipulated that the sound of the movie should be, quote, "white and literate rhythm and blues with a rock life." Polly wondered from the beginning if the songs were really necessary.
It was a brilliant script, funny and about Hollywood, but the dance and song moments seemed to me to be tagged on for no reason. That was the first thing I said to Jim when I read the draft for the first time. Why is it a musical? He ignored that question. I couldn't see how the musical numbers would work in the story. I said, I think you really have to follow some rules. You're making a musical. I think you have to work with a lyricist and a composer.
Penny Finkelman Cox was a producer on I'll Do Anything.
In a traditional musical, you hire one songwriter who writes words. You hire either a team or someone who does both. But if you don't work that way, the music doesn't really fit in with the script. And Jim really didn't work collaboratively like that. So he found it very difficult to work collaboratively. And I think we all knew that his approach, he was entitled to try what he wanted. But in my background and training with musicals, and I have a lot of musical background, it was just the wrong thing to do because nothing ever came together.
Paula Harold did the casting for the film.
And also, a friend of mine who's a composer who actually went in to be a composer on the project and opened his big mouth so he didn't get the job. He's a famous composer now. He said to Jim, you should have written this with a composer. You can't write a movie and then put in the music. And that's obviously what they did.
Another complication was that Brooks decided to hire a cast of main actors with little to no musical talent.
Jim cast Nick Nolte, who cannot sing, as the out-of-work actor, Albert Brooks, who can sing but can't dance, as the Hollywood producer, and Julie Kavner, who really can't sing at all, in the role of the research woman. We couldn't find any woman to play the development girl called D-Girl in the movie business. Jolie Richardson ended up playing that part after a hair-raising hunt. She had no songs to sing.
Once casting was complete, rehearsals began. But the film still didn't have its original songs.
Jim and Penny hired the well-known New Yorker, Twyla Tharp, to choreograph the movie. But we didn't have any music. So she just rehearsed her dancers to her own choice of music and invited us all in to do routines with her. That was fun. But what did it have to do with the movie? She had to have a dance studio to rehearse in, and there wasn't one big enough with the right flooring. So I had a floor built into a storefront, and she rehearsed there.
With no songs written for the movie, Tharp put dancers through routines set to CDs she had brought in, including The Best of Sam and Dave and Elvis Presley Sings Lieber and Stoller. Polly thought this was a waste of time.
So she rehearsed some more to some music, and we dicked around with that. Jim kept telling me she was a genius, but I didn't see any genius. I thought her choreography uninspired.
Penny Finkelman Cox brought Tharp onto the movie and felt that Polly was jealous and resentful of having to compete with the choreographer for Brooks's attention and affirmation.
Polly did not like working with Twyla because Twyla's the real thing. There's no getting around it. The depth of her talent and initiative as a choreographer was beyond Polly. I mean, she just didn't understand it. And the jealousy was formidable. You know how you have people sitting on the sets watching takes, and the two of them, damn it, would fight for who sat next to Jim. And it was just the silliest thing.
Certainly, Polly felt she had earned the right to sit next to Jim. And she felt she needed to be there in order to have the influence she wanted to have on the film. She had already had an influence on the writing, again lending parts of her personality to one of the female characters. This time, the market research executive played by Julie Kavner, who is brutally honest in her first conversation with Nick Nolte's down-on-his-luck actor character.
Oh, please. It's one thing to be a son of a bitch. You don't have to be a stupid son of a bitch. People move heaven on earth to see their kids. I don't care if she moved to Pluto. It's abandonment.
Hey, wait a minute. We just met.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And then, when they meet a second time, she apologizes for her outburst and explains that there's a medical reason for her honesty.
I began taking antidepressants when we moved here from Washington. I had some side effects. Sleeping 14 hours, no libido. I gained 17 pounds in 9 days, that sort of thing. So they gave me pills to deal with the side effects. Then pills to deal with the side effects I was getting from those pills. All this besides the stuff the nutritionist was giving me. The combination formed some sort of potion, so I keep telling the truth. I don't have a choice. That's why I was so rude to you. It's true.
Writer Lisa Maria Redano believed Brooks had written this aspect of the character with Polly in mind.
So he created a character, like a very mercurial character who can only tell you exactly what she's thinking in a world where nobody does that, right? Like it's all about fake appearances and playing the game. And the Julie Kavner character is like, she can only say exactly what's true in her own thoughts. And that was Polly. That had to have been Polly that was based on.
For what it's worth, the scene in which Kavner attributes her honesty to the side effects of her meds was added as part of the reshoot process. In real life, Polly's compulsive truth-telling couldn't be explained away so easily. And it didn't always have the desired effect. Throughout the process of making I'll Do Anything, Polly felt her influence waning. Antonia Bogdanovich worked on the movie as an apprentice editor.
There were many things that my mom tried to do on that film and she wasn't really listened to. And I think that was hard for her.
But Polly did score a win when it came to the music. Prince, then known as the artist formerly known as Prince due to his legal dispute with Warner Brothers, agreed to meet about writing most of the songs. Polly, who was a huge fan of his music, was elated.
I was so excited that I was jumping up and down, pumping my fists with a gesture of success when he walked out of the elevator with his retinue and caught me at it. How unprofessional of me. But he smiled, and I could tell he liked me. I was dressed in coveralls and a t-shirt, and he was dressed in a yellow and green outfit, wearing makeup and high-heeled boots. He was sucking on a sugar pop. He listened to Jim go on in his brilliant way about the film, and the artist formerly known as Prince said nothing at all during the whole show. Then he stood up, threw the pop stick in the trash barrel, and said quietly that he would love to do the movie. Then he left.
Prince would write at least 7 songs for the movie, which were inserted into the script alongside one song by Sinead O'Connor and one by Carole King. With these missing pieces in place, I'll Do Anything started shooting in late 1992. In an LA Times story that ran in August 1993, Polly would defend Brooks's decision to make I'll Do Anything as a musical.
I think he felt that he couldn't capture the romance, the bravura, the inanity, and the brilliance of this town without reaching up to another level. He knows how audacious this is, to get the characters to say things in song that in dialogue they would never say.
Polly could present a united front publicly, But behind the scenes, she was extremely skeptical.
For me, we were headed for disaster. Since we were on the lot shooting, all the executives came to visit. They seemed happy. I would walk out of the screening room of dailies, and whatever guest was there would say, "Well, you're not in trouble. You know, this is good. This is fine." And I'm looking at the footage saying, "This is not working." Maybe I was crazy. I felt that I was being dragged through a madhouse. Was I the only one who hated Twyla Tharp's choreography? Was I the only one who felt Nick Nolte couldn't sing? When Twyla got 100 tap dancers to dance behind Albert Brooks, was I the only one who thought he looked foolish because he couldn't dance?
Polly may have been the only one on set who was second-guessing Twyla Tharp, but the lack of musical talent among the main actors was not really a matter of subjective opinion.
But then, because Jim was doing it all differently, and he also insisted that the actors sing their own stuff, well, to have Julie Kavner sing an emotional song, you know her voice, Julie Kavner?
Julie Kavner is the voice of Marge Simpson.
Yeah, well, she used to sing her own songs, and we used to have to go in the studio and get her whack-a-mole drunk because she just hated to sing.
One day when we were shooting Julie Kavner singing, Prince called my office and requested a chair and a monitor far from the shooting area. He was not to be spoken to and didn't want to be seen. I arranged this for him and waited. He showed up, the man who didn't want to be noticed, and he was wearing a hot pink suit with high-heeled boots to match and was made up with mascara and eyeliner. We all tried to ignore him as he settled into his secluded spot and watched the monitor as Julie began to sing his song, "I Can't Love You Anymore." She sang off-key and was worse than bad. She was awful. I watched Prince listen to his song being mangled, and he was expressionless. No winces, no looking around. I ventured over to speak to him despite his ban on being spoken to. "This is not how the song will be in the movie," I told him. "We will have someone else sing the song on the soundtrack later." He nodded as if I had commented on the weather. He stayed a few minutes more and left as quietly as he arrived. I wondered what he thought. A couple of days later, he called me and told me he wanted to do a remake of Some Like It Hot by Billy Wilder, and would I be interested in producing it for him. He was quite talkative on the phone, very ordinary. It was hard not to call him Prince.
Tensions ran high throughout the shoot, and Polly fell off the wagon. She was not the only person using booze to cope, as Kelly Wade, who was then working as Polly's assistant, recalls.
Yes, everybody was really heavily drinking on I'll Do Anything. Part of our job was to have a cart that we would bring over to the screening room for dailies that was sort of like this moving bar that had like wine and whatnot. So when everybody left the set to go watch dailies at the screening room at Sony, we would bring the cart over of all the goodies. So everybody was drinking a lot.
But it also seems clear that Polly was increasingly dissatisfied with her role at Gracie, and her resentment led to hostility and self-destruction. Drinking heightened Polly's emotions and decimated her self-control, which led to an incident with Paula Harold.
It was on a Friday, and they were looking at dailies in Jim's office. Polly's office was right next door to Jim Brooks, and I guess they were having a discussion about Nick Nolte's, you know, outfit. And Jim said, "You know, what do you think? Should we redo the scene and change what he's wearing or just leave it as it is?" So I just said, "You know, it looks fine to me." And then I guess talking to Jim, and I guess Polly went into her office, and I guess she was drinking. It was Friday afternoon. So then I walked out, and Polly's in her office. I said, "Good night, Polly." And she goes, "I don't want to say good night to you after what you said." And I go, "What?" And she said, "About what you said about the costumes." I said, "You're saying goodnight to me." I went to shake, put my hand out, and the next thing I knew, her hands were around my throat. And she pushed me, and Richard Sakai happened to walk by, and he ran and got Jim, and they, like, pulled her hands off my throat. And Jim said, "Polly, you might want to take up exercise. I understand it relieves tension." And I'm sure everybody thought I was going to cry, but there, as I said, there was no way that I would ever cry. And I'll tell you that over the weekend, Polly called to apologize. And I think she stopped drinking then.
Polly came from a very creative place and never, ever wanted to sacrifice that creativity.
This is David Moritz, the associate editor on I'll Do Anything.
And when she did, she compromised herself only because I think of the pressures that were on her. And I don't know if you've heard, you know, enough about the whole alcohol thing and all that. It's probably overdone, but if ever there was a person who said, well, Jesus, how am I going to, you know, relax tonight after I get beat up like this, it would have been Polly Platt.
Calling all pop culture enthusiasts.
Are you obsessed with all things celebrity?
Do you live for the drama, the laughs, and the unexpected moments that unfold on social media?
Then you're going to want to tune in to the Comments by Celebs podcast.
Join us three times a week as we deep dive into every aspect of pop culture.
Whether it's dissecting the latest trends or just chatting about your favorite celebs, Comments by Celebs has you covered.
We have new episodes out every week. Follow and listen to Comments by Celebs on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The post-production of I'll Do Anything stretched throughout 1993. Polly was very present for this process, but she was creatively frustrated. Stacey Scher got to know Polly around this time when Stacey went to work at Danny DeVito's production company, Jersey Films, which had its offices near Gracie's on the Sony lot. At Jersey, Stacey would produce Reality Bites, Pulp Fiction, Man in the Moon, Out of Sight, and more. Something exciting was happening on the Sony lot at that time. It felt like a hub for a new generation of filmmakers infiltrating the Hollywood system.
Reality Bites was still being written. Pulp Fiction was still being written. Everybody was in the Jersey offices. And Cameron Crowe's offices were over at Gracie, and I had become friendly with him by that point. And we would all see each other in the parking lot, and we would all hang out in each other's offices and just talk about film and writers and things we'd seen that we'd loved. And it was a real community.
Stacey was part of the younger generation, but she drew inspiration from Polly and her generation and legacy.
Of course, I knew everything about her because she was this larger-than-life character, you know, because we all studied the way that Peter and Polly studied those who came before them. We studied them, too. And there weren't that many women in the mix. So, of course, I was always drawn to reading about them and learning about them. One of my most vivid memories is Polly Platt, Richard LeGravenez, and I hanging out in my apartment. And we were watching the movie Shampoo. And I've seen Shampoo more as much as any film I've ever seen. I think it's a perfect film. And I remember we were sitting there, and it was about to be the scene when we meet Julie Christie for the first time, and she's wearing these incredible sunglasses. And Polly goes, "Laszlo Kovacs, get your lights out of her glasses." And I had watched this film more than anything I've ever seen, and I'd never noticed that. And that's Polly. She had the most extraordinary eye for any detail. She was like a focuser and a truth teller, no matter how inconvenient it was. You know, she would say anything that came into her mind. She had a very distinct view of stuff, and her passion and her religion was the art of filmmaking. You know, nothing else mattered except for getting it right. You know, she was a true perfectionist in every part of her vision, and I think in a way, because she recognized excellence, and her pursuit of excellence was so ingrained in who she was, it was very hard for her to tolerate anything less than in the people she loved, in the people she worked with, and in everything.
Feeling like her voice was somewhat constrained, Polly took time to express herself in two other venues. She adapted a short story by W.P. Kinsella into a short film called Lieberman in Love. Directed by and co-starring actress Christine Lottie, it would win the Oscar for Best Live-Action Short in 1996. And then, Polly participated in Rachel Abramowitz's definitive profile for Premiere magazine, which introduced Platt to a new generation, while also resurrecting the old conversation about Polly's contribution to the films of her ex-husband. With Abramowitz sitting in her office, and with a glass of wine in her hand, Polly called Peter and bragged about the project she was working on.
Then she asked Peter to talk to the reporter, and he refused. That made Polly angry.
I've been talking all these fucking years about you.
The profile also presented an image of Polly's current bond with Brooks as having risen to the level of her past bond with Peter. But one crucial difference is that with Bogdanovich, Polly had enjoyed being the most influential voice in the room. Now, on I'll Do Anything, she was competing for influence, and not always winning. She lost a major battle when it came to the film's first test screening.
I begged Jim to preview the film out of town. I was worried. People in Hollywood are curious about people doing something as daring as a musical, and I was afraid someone would get in who might badmouth the film. But Jim was superstitious. He wanted to screen it at the Cary Grant Theater on the lot at Sony as he had his other films. Great security measures were in place. People had to show their ID to get in, and the line formed for the audience. And I walked along the line to see if I recognized anybody from the movie world. I sat with Jim and his wife Holly as the movie started. We got through the first song, and I grabbed Jim's hand. We made it through that one. Then the second song came on, and all of a sudden, people started getting up and leaving. There were lots of them. And the Cary Grant Theater was under construction, and the people leaving had to go down to the front of the screen to exit, and their shadows on the screen as they left made it look like double the amount of people leaving. But it was a rout. We lost at least a third of the audience. We sat through the rest of the film, and more people left.
This is David Moritz.
Okay, so my remembrance of that is that there was one guy, two people tried to sneak out. And they went to the doors that were behind the screen, basically, down to the right and left at the Sony Hitchcock. And the doors, of course, were locked. And all you could hear was, you know, those bars that you push was like, like people trying to escape the screening. And I remember Jim going, oh, my God, he was behind me, 2 feet behind me, going, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God.
I was in shock. This was something that happens to other people, not us. This is the sort of thing that's written about in a novel about Hollywood. I wanted to do what's called a focus group with about 20 people. Their opinions about the film would be interesting and might help us, but Jim called it off. We shuffled back to Gracie, speechless. Jim pulled out a bottle of tequila and we all got drunk. I went home to bed and thought about the colossal failure of the film. Hadn't I seen it coming? Yes. But that made it worse. I wanted to be wrong.
On Monday morning, Polly got a call from a prominent entertainment journalist.
She asked me if it was true that Saturday night we had massive walkouts on our test screening. I started to deny it, and she interrupted me and told me that Sunday night, she and her husband had dinner with a couple who had been at the screening, not film people, and they told her of the mass exodus. I begged her not to publish a story on it. I said it was a first rough cut, and we were trying out a few risky things. I said it would be like publishing a rough draft of one of her articles. I pleaded and begged, and then I went to tell Jim. He was horrified and called his publicist, Pat Kingsley, and she came right over. Between the three of us, we brokered an agreement that the reporter wouldn't write a story about the disastrous screening, but that she would follow us through the whole editing and screening process, and then she would write a piece on the whole process. This really crippled Jim. He needed freedom from the press to try out variations on the film for various audiences. And with a reporter there, he was always under the gun. Mark Canton was the head of the studio then, and he was really remarkable. We screened the movie for him, and at one good scene, he would ask out loud, "Did they laugh at that? Did they walk out on that?" He seemed totally on our side and was dismayed at our predicament. Naturally, it affected his job, too. We spent a lot of money on that film.
The fact that Canton was so supportive of I'll Do Anything was more remarkable, given that the studio was then reeling from the failure of his personal pet project, The Last Action Hero, an expensive fiasco which would lose something in the neighborhood of $50 million, which was a lot of money for a movie to lose then. In fact, it was partially because of Last Action Hero that the local press was vigilantly watching for Columbia to fail again. In the end, Brooks participated in a series of articles in the Los Angeles Times, ostensibly as a salve to the bad press about the first test screening. But these articles cemented the idea that I'll Do Anything was a movie in trouble. In a major irony, given that this was a movie about Hollywood's emotional and commercial dependence on test screenings, anytime anyone wrote anything about the film, they reiterated the fact that the filmmakers were fighting their way back from a disastrous first test screening. They also noted that, in that test screening, the music had been the problem. I'll Do Anything had originally been scheduled for release at the end of 1993, in time for Oscar consideration. But through a number of additional test screenings that summer, the form of the film began to change significantly. It became apparent that audiences could not get on board with the musical numbers. Come September, Brooks acknowledged in the LA Times that they were testing a version with no music at all. By that point, Antonio Bogdanovich had been working in the editing room for over a year.
We had shot a musical. Nobody agreed that we should take the music out, but we had to make do with what was happening.
Polly, like a good producer, always fell in love with her projects. She kind of loved that project, but I think she always knew it was a fish with feathers.
This is Polly's friend, Nancy Griffin, who co-wrote Hit and Run, a book about Sony Pictures' disastrous early 1990s, I'll Do Anything included.
There were parts of it that she adored, and I remember sitting in a screening with her, and I remember I was sitting behind her, and I just remember she would kind of like say some of the lines with the actor, and then if there was a good joke, she would laugh. And I thought, oh my God, Polly has seen this movie so many times and watched different edits of it so many times, and yet she still seems to be delighted by it.
On October 1st, The Hollywood Reporter announced that the studio had moved the film off the Christmas season release date and bumped it to the icy wasteland of February 4th. This was heartbreaking, because it showed the I'll Do Anything team what the studio really thought of the movie, as Paula Harold explains.
We were supposed to open for the Academy, and then we're going to open in February, which is, you know, when they release Bombs.
On November 23rd, Brooks admitted to the LA Times that I'll Do Anything would no longer be a musical. There was no way to do it where the music didn't stop the story for the audience and break the feeling of reality, he said. I just couldn't fight it anymore. But taking the music out didn't fix I'll Do Anything. In fact, disasters kept happening, almost to the point of comedy.
Right in the middle of our press screenings, the Great Northridge earthquake happened in the early morning of January 17th, 1994. It was particularly bad in Santa Monica, where I lived. I went over to see Sashi, Kelly, and Antonia to see if they were all right. And after driving through the shattered, windowless Wilshire Boulevard, I bought a six-pack and went to bed with my shoes on. The doorbell rang around 11 o'clock, and when I got out of bed and opened the door, there was a big black limousine waiting to take me to the interviews with the foreign press. I didn't think any would attend. I didn't even know if the Four Seasons Hotel was still standing. The driver was in uniform and I was in my sweats and told him to leave. Our big opening screening was in Westwood, and there were after tremors from the earthquake during the screening, but no one got up and left. There was a big party afterwards and compliments were forthcoming. People liked the movie. Jack Nicholson was there and said nice things. We were hoping the movie would overcome its own difficulties. It was February of 1994, and we opened to mixed reviews.
That was an understatement, and the last statement Polly would make in her writing on I'll Do Anything. The film got two thumbs up from Siskel and Ebert and was positively reviewed in the New York Times by Janet Maslin. But the publicity about the rocky production process and what Brooks himself referred to in Time magazine as the ripple effect left by the excised musical numbers were noted as reasons to mock the finished product in reviews by many high-profile critics, including Anthony Lane, John Powers,
and Jay Hoberman. I'll Do Anything cast a temporary pall on the whole Gracie Films experience, as Paula Harold explains.
Yeah, I mean, that changed my relationship with you, and probably lots of people. I mean, I worked so hard, you know, it was just heartbreaking. Because we put our, you know, hearts and souls in this movie, and then isn't it one of the biggest bombs of all time?
I'll Do Anything doesn't always make the list of Hollywood's biggest bombs, but probably only because it's forgettable, which is worse. The movie's cost ballooned to over $40 million, and its total box office gross would be less than a quarter of that, making it, proportionately, a bigger money loser than Last Action Hero or The Cotton Club, one of the musical disasters that Polly had raised the specter of when Brooks first told her he wanted to make the movie. Polly would say that she dove into another film, the last satisfying experience of her career as a producer, as a respite.
It was agonizing and painful, and I think I definitely turned to Bottle Rocket for solace.
Bottle Rocket began as a very short script, 60 pages of dialogue with no character descriptions, written by two college friends in Dallas, Owen Wilson and Wes Anderson. Wilson, who had never acted before, planned to star in the movie, and Anderson, who had never directed, planned to direct. Owen and Wes met independent film legend L.M. Kit Carson through Owen's father, who knew him through the Texas public television world. Carson sent the 60-page script to Barbara Boyle, the former head of Roger Corman's New World Pictures, and then an independent producer. Barbara talked to Owen and Wes about expanding their 60 pages into a full, conventionally formatted shooting script.
Okay, ready for this? Now 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks go by, and sure enough, I get a new script. So this script is 120 pages long. The margins are so wide. The printing is so small that it's actually about 190 pages. And it has become a novel with dialogue interspersed.
Boyle continued to work with the writers for several months and encouraged them to film a small portion of their doorstop script as a sample for potential investors and studios of what Wes Anderson could do.
I thought, I've got to see how this kid directs. He's never had, doesn't have a piece of film on him. Not a student film. He was a philosophy major. The toss-up with Wes was going to Yale to get his PhD in philosophy or making a movie.
Boyle sent the long script and the short film to her contacts at several major companies and got no takers.
And then I send it to Polly. And I remember she called me on a Sunday, and she said, now, this isn't half bad. Tell me who these guys are. And then Polly called me up a week or so later and said, Jim wants to see you, like, right now.
Even at 175 pages, I wanted to make it a lot. I remembered that clause in Gracie's deal that we could make any picture we wanted if it was less than $20 million. I figured we could make this picture for $5 million. I saw two movie stars on the tape and felt that the director was extremely talented. Somehow, in the midst of casting I'll Do Anything, I got Jim's attention and shoved the tape into his VCR and played it for him and Albert Brooks, who was in the office. I told him Owen Wilson was a movie star, and so was Luke, his brother, and the director was great and I could make it for $5 million. Jim liked the tape and we started negotiations.
Jim, Barbara, and Polly got on the Sony jet and flew to Dallas to meet Wes and Owen and Luke Wilson.
They staged a reading for Jim in a hot, non-air-conditioned room, and Luke was sweating like a pig, but they were all quite good, and Jim was pleased. Wes Anderson chased after me as we were leaving and asked if we were going to make his movie, and I said, yes.
For what it's worth, when Wes Anderson has told this story in the past, he said it was Brooks who assured him that Gracie was going to make the movie. Regardless of who said what, Polly felt real ownership over making Bottle Rocket happen. Sometime after that, Polly opened a bottle of wine in her Gracie Films office and called Peter to tell him about this new movie she was going to produce. She told him it reminded her of the last picture show, with one crucial change: her position of power. The script for Bottle Rocket still needed a lot of work, and a protracted script development process was required before Gracie could move forward. So Owen and Wes were brought from Texas to L.A., where Gracie put them up at a motel in Century City, in the shadow of the Fox lot. They lived there for months, on the studio's dime, while Polly and Jim pushed the boys to flesh out the characters and their motivations, and to determine, as Owen Wilson wrote in a note to Brooks, "What are we trying to say here?" Throughout, Polly was serving as a cheerleader on behalf of the boys, to try to overcome skepticism within Gracie that the movie was worth making. On one batch of script notes, Polly wrote to Brooks,
"What a luxury that we can make a script like this so inexpensively. The timing is, in cinematic terms, unique. Let's hurry up. Let's make this soon."
One reason why Polly may have been pushing so ardently to get the green light quick was that, by this time, she knew she wouldn't be at Gracie for much longer, which we'll get to later. But there was another reason to act fast. This was during the summer of 1993, at a time when there seemed to be a real demand in the culture for the discovery of new talents who could prove themselves through low-budget features. Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Gus Van Sant's Drugstore Cowboy and My Own Private Idaho, Whit Stillman's Metropolitan, Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs. These movies had made money, and some had even been nominated for Oscars. Over 20 years after she had been part of the last American independent directors boom, Polly saw a strike-while-the-zeitgeist iron-is-hot scenario. There were voices within Gracie Films who saw that very trendiness as a reason for caution. Diane Brooks, Jim's older sister, who was part of the Gracie Films brain trust, wrote a memo confiding that she simply didn't get what Bottle Rocket was all about. She was, she wrote, very concerned that Polly and Jim were getting carried away with the thought of releasing an innovative, untouched by Hollywood movie that was being done cheaply by fresh young talent. But Diane worried that this was a case of the emperor having no clothes. Though this was not the end of the skepticism surrounding Bottle Rocket, Polly's faith in the film won out to the extent that it went into production in the fall of 1994 in Dallas. Right around the time, independent film mania hit its peak with the release of Pulp Fiction, a movie Gracie's home studio, Columbia, had passed on producing. It had taken a lot of producers to get Bottle Rocket into production, but at the end of the day, Polly was the only producer left who went to location and stayed there, producing on set every day. Polly had already shepherded Cameron Crowe through the process of making his first film within a studio, but Say Anything, while identifiably a personal, idiosyncratic movie, was much more conventional, particularly in terms of genre and aesthetics, than Bottle Rocket. Right away, the footage coming back to L.A. from the Bottle Rocket set sent up red flags amongst the executives, who were of a markedly different generation than the boys. Polly went on a limb to hire David Moritz, who had been working on other Gracie films under master editor Richard Marks, who was David's wife's father, as the chief editor on Bottle Rocket.
Right from the beginning, it was clear to me that Jim and Columbia, and certainly Richie Marks, my father-in-law, when they would look at dailies, were going, what is this? I don't even know what the fuck this movie is. This is the strangest thing I've ever seen. And so they couldn't quite wrap their head around it. They knew it was original, and they knew that Wes was a talent. What they didn't realize that I had learned very early on was that Wes had a resolve and a certain amount of, no, this is what I know, what I've been born to do, as all auteurs and real original artists are, and resisted anybody trying to, you know, mess with what he thought his formula was.
One of the issues was that Wes Anderson was resistant to shooting conventional coverage, which is the term used for the standard pattern of wide shots, medium shots, and close-ups that cinematographers and directors are typically expected to produce, so that there are options in the editing room. But as this film's editor Moritz explains, Wes Anderson didn't feel like he needed those conventional options because he had his own vision for how the film would be edited.
And I kept saying, I thought the coverage was wonderful and interesting and that it was really fun to edit. And they go, well, aren't you going to get in trouble if you want to, you know, cut from A to B later on in a very sort of traditional Hollywood sense? Wes and I would just go, we called it the radio play. If you close your eyes and listen to the dialogue, it would sound perfectly normal. But maybe the cuts weren't perfectly normal to go with it. They were the ones that drove Richie and Jim crazy and we loved.
Polly was also concerned that the footage might not cut together well, but she also fought to let Wes shoot the movie he wanted to make.
We got to a very complicated scene in the kitchen of the motel where we were shooting. We shot it, and Jim was so unhappy with the results that he wanted to fly down and direct it himself. I told Wes that he had to be strong and insistent and not let Jim come down. I said, if you let Jim come down here and direct your scene, it will be like he fucked your girlfriend every time you see the scene in your first movie. I called Jim and told him that if after we cut the scene together in post-production and he was still unhappy with it, I would find a motel kitchen in LA and Jim could direct it then. That did it, and Jim didn't come down. The script came alive wonderfully, and I knew we had a good movie. Finally, we finished shooting and went back to Jim and Gracie to cut the picture. 1995 was entirely about working on a final cut of Bottle Rocket. It took so long because Jim had to be there, and he was simply not there for days. His beloved sister was dying, she had a new heart and had also developed cancer, and Jim spent a lot of time with her away from our cutting rooms.
This is where Polly's memoir ends. In the middle of page 337, not quite in the middle of a sentence, but seemingly definitely in the middle of a thought. What happened next? Brooks's sister Diane would pass away in May 1995. By then, Polly had left Gracie Films and had a new job, which we'll talk about next week. David Moritz recalls that he and Anderson were mostly left alone in the editing process, but when Polly did weigh in, as usual, she would get right to the point.
I'm just going to say this. That was Polly's thing. I'm just going to say this. And then you went, oh, God, I hope it's good. That's what it was. She would say, honey, I'm just going to say this. And then she would lay out for you what she thought of either of a scene that you edited or the circumstances that was going on, or certainly during Bottle Rocket, she did that a lot.
Moritz and Wes Anderson kept plugging away at the edit on Bottle Rocket. The process was prolonged by test screenings, which did not go well. The first one took place on May 22nd, 1995, and out of 330 attendees, there were 85 walkouts. People were just not drawn into the movie, period, wrote Gracie Films executive Julie Ansel to Brooks. A big comment from the focus group is that this film is meaningless. Ansel consulted Polly, who suggested they needed to try to insert more close-ups on the theory that the audiences would respond to the characters more if they could make an emotional connection to the actors. So editing continued on, to the point that by the end of October, Columbia, the studio that paid Gracie's bills and released its movies, asked Brooks to pay $160,000 out of his own pocket to help cover the massive post-production overages. The next blow came when Sundance, which had debuted the Bottle Rocket short, declined to accept the full-length film. It was also rejected by the major fall film festivals, including New York and Telluride. Without that important launching pad for this idiosyncratic film that they really didn't know how to market anyway, Columbia cut their expectations and their spending budget, reducing Bottle Rocket to an art house release. When Bottle Rocket grossed $130,000 on 28 screens opening weekend for a per-screen average of $4,600, the trade paper coverage was positive. But after 5 weeks, the movie had only made about $500,000, which was problematic because, according to Brooks's papers, the final cost to make it had swelled to nearly $7 million. In comparison, in 2 weeks on just about the same number of screens at the same time, another quirky crime film, Fargo, had grossed $2.4 million. But in an anomaly for a movie that lost money, Hollywood loved Bottle Rocket, and a bidding war began for Wes Anderson and Owen Wilson's next project. As Barbara Boyle recalls,
the irony to me was after Bottle Rocket opened, every studio head I had been to visit came to see it. My husband's, I came home from work one day and the phone was disconnected. And I said, what did you do? What happened to our phone? You unconnected it. He said, you know what? It was ringing all day and it was you and they're looking for Wes or Owen. And they sounded like agents to me. So, you know, their life began not because of the grosses of that movie, was because people who saw it in the industry thought it was incredible.
Regardless of how Bottle Rocket performed, that the industry was now clamoring to work with these filmmakers Polly had nurtured was vindication of her hard work, her taste, and the fact that she had backed up her faith with Columbia's cash, as David Moritz explains.
She was proud of the movie. She was proud of the fact that she, without Polly Platt, there may not have been a Wes Anderson, because no studio or no independent production company would have taken it upon themselves to let Wes and Owen live in a hotel for several months, develop the script, come to this beautiful, insanely creative environment that was Gracie Films at the time, soak that all up.
Much later, when Wes Anderson won a Golden Globe for the Grand Budapest Hotel, he would acknowledge Polly, who had passed away 4 years earlier.
Thank you, thank you. I'm not going to spend many of my few seconds up here thanking people like Stephen Rails and Scott Rudin and Jim Giannopoulos and Nancy Utley and Steve Galula, Juman and Owen, Rafe and Hugo, Jeremy and Bill, Roman and Jason, Randy and Edward and Adrian and Jeff and Tilda, Jim and Rich, and especially James L. Brooks and Polly Platt. Instead, I'm going to focus on the membership of the Hollywood Foreign Press, Yoram and Dagmar and Yukiko and
Polly was no longer at Gracie to champion Bottle Rocket when it came to determining its release or promotional budget. But she did do interviews about the movie. She believed that Bottle Rocket captured something timeless about young men. And in a way, she was the expert. A big February 1996 story in Esquire magazine posited Say Anything and Bottle Rocket as bookends of a cultural moment, and observed that the latter film, quote, captures something honest about this generation in much the same way that Diner, Saturday Night Fever, and Easy Rider did for their devotees. Polly's collaboration with James L. Brooks had resulted in three films that told parts of Polly's own story through their female characters. Terms of Endearment, Broadcast News, and I'll Do Anything. But two of the films on which she took the most hands-on roles, Say Anything and Bottle Rocket, were perceived as being films about rootless young men in the lineage of The Last Picture Show. Of course, that was part of Polly's own story, too. It was a hell of a track record for just over 10 years. But now, Polly moved on. She would later say it was her idea, her plan, to see Bottle Rocket through as her last act with Gracie.
I knew this was a little movie and that we would have trouble selling it, and I was right. In my mind, I really didn't think that it would become the flop that it was. I was just determined to make it, and I decided that's what I was going to do, and that I was going to leave Gracie after that, which I did.
But the truth is that Polly Platt's career transition in the mid-90s was more complicated. I asked a lot of people if they knew why Polly left Gracie Films. Some people said they didn't know. Others told me they did know, but didn't want to talk about it, or would only speak off the record. When in doubt, reporters are supposed to follow the money. One way to do that in reporting on Hollywood is to look at contracts. And lucky for me, Polly's contract with Gracie was donated to the Academy Library as part of the James L. Brooks papers. At the end of 1992, she was given a one-year extension, due to come up for renewal at the end of 1993. At that point, the I'll Do Anything saga was finally almost over, and Gracie was committed to producing Bottle Rocket the following year. But I couldn't find in the files any evidence that Polly was signed to a new contract. She would be paid her guaranteed bonus for producing Bottle Rocket, but it looked from the paper trail that her existing contract, guaranteeing an escalating salary, perks, and a physical and emotional home within the Gracie Films family, was allowed to lapse. That was confirmed by her then assistant, Kelly Wade.
My knowledge was that they did not renew her contract. I was shocked. I thought it maybe had something to do with I'll Do Anything, the fact that it wasn't a success, but I don't know.
A few people I spoke to blamed that film's failure, and particularly the fact that Polly had predicted that it wouldn't work as a musical, as a major factor in the disintegration of her working relationship with Jim Brooks. A partial consensus seems to be that, ultimately, the messenger was killed. But by the time the movie came out and was confirmed to be a money loser, it had also become clear that Polly wanted something out of the job that she was no longer getting. Here's Penny Finkelman Cox.
I think on I'll Do Anything, Polly pictured herself as Jim's right-hand person, which I think he intended it to be that way too. Look, I personally think she wanted to be Jim's partner, and I don't think he did want it as a partnership as much as you work for me and you do what I want you to do. He loves people, and he loves to have, if he can get five opinions, he's happy. But she wanted to be the opinion. She wanted what she had with Peter. It wasn't going to happen with Jim. Jim has a very, very strong ego, as most people know. And he's not a traditional straight line director in the sense that he loves to have moments that take you by surprise. And it's in his head how he comes up with that. So you can only share so much and collaborate so much when all of his riches are sort of in his brain. But I guess with Polly and Peter, it was always a shared moment, I guess.
Someone close to Polly at the time told me that Brooks wanted the people who worked for him to compete to come up with great ideas and to compete for Jim's attention. Several people told me the conflict this generated was part of Brooks's creative process. Here's David Moritz.
But the whole thing in that whole Gracie world was built somewhat upon Jim's crafting together a series of people who butted heads, and I think he kind of distilled all the information from it, sort of sitting above it all. The great thing about Polly that I always respected was that for the characters that were at Gracie, they kind of played the smart card all the time to self-preserve, which is fine. Of course, that's what you got to do. Polly wasn't really that person. Jim could play the benevolent soul, but he could be neurotic as hell. If you had somebody who said, hey, man, fuck you, I'm not really sure what you have to say about that. I'm going to speak my mind. It made him very uncomfortable.
It also led to conflict with members of the team who were better at Hollywood politics, because Polly wasn't a politician.
Oh, my God, no. If she was, she was as blunt as they could be. And I guess she'd be the Trump of her generation. Not her political leanings, but she was that person, man. I'm going to say what I want. You don't like it? I don't care. And I'll say it sober tonight and tomorrow night. If we're having drinks, I'm going to say the same thing. I'm going to say it louder. But I always loved her for it.
I think it's unfortunate that their working relationship soured.
This is Kelly Wade.
She didn't see it coming. And maybe because she was drinking, she didn't see it coming. But I don't think that they treated her fairly. No. For all that she gave to them and as hard as she worked, no. It was completely unfair.
Polly Platt would live for another decade and a half, none of which she wrote about in her memoir. We will talk about those years, her tragic death, and her legacy in our final episode next week. Thanks for listening to You Must Remember This. Today's episode was produced, written, and narrated by Karina Longworth. That's me. Special thanks to our special guest, Maggie Siff, who read the words of Polly Platt. Today's episode included excerpts from interviews with Rachel Abramowitz, Penny Finkelman Cox, Antonia Bogdanovich, Lisa Maria Redano, Kelly Wade, Paula Harold, David Moritz, Stacy Scher, Nancy Griffin, and Barbara Boyle. Special thanks to them and everyone else who took the time to talk about Polly Platt with us. Our research and production assistant is Lindsay D. Schoenholtz. Brendan Whalen is in charge of our social media and does additional research assistance. Additional research assistance and transcription by Kristen Sales and Wiley Wiggins. Our logo was designed by Teddy Blanks. Today's episode was produced by Tomika Weatherspoon and edited and mixed by Brendan Burns. Our executive producers are Chris Bannon and Josephine Martirana. For more information about this episode and other episodes, please go to our website, youmustrememberthispodcast.com. There you'll find show notes, which include all of our sources, information about music, and much more. If you like the show, please tell anyone you can, any way that you can. You can follow us on Twitter at Remember This Pod, and we're also on Instagram and Facebook. And you can support the show on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/Karina Longworth or buy merch for our show at podswag.com/remember. Keep up with all of our episodes by subscribing on Stitcher or wherever you find your podcasts. We'll be back next week with another tale from the secret and or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century. Join us then, won't you? Good night.